Indie Prime, yes, Indie Prime, on Indie Live Radio. Indie Prime, yes, Indie Prime, on Indie Live Radio.
Welcome to the latest Indie Prime podcast on Independence Live Radio. My guest this week is Michael Heaney. Michael, very good day to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Ray.
Right, Michael, now you've done some very, very interesting, at least for the independence movement in Scotland, and that's what that you've done a survey.
So I've done a survey of the people demonstrating at independence rallies in Aberdeen, Perth, Edinburgh, and Glasgow.
Super.
And in doing that, I've worked with a team of students from the University of Glasgow. And I'm also writing about those surveys with Erica Anderson, Madeline Cancrow, and Grace Martin, who are all graduate students in the School of Social and Political Sciences here at the University of Glasgow.
Great. Well, we can get onto the survey in a moment. First of all, I'd like to hear about yourself, your background, your experience, your history, your involvement in the surveys. Okay.
I am a political scientist by training. I earned my PhD at the University of Chicago in political science and public policy. In the United States, I've worked at the University of Florida and the University of Michigan. One of my areas of interest is the study of social movements, and I've written a book about the anti-war movement in the United States with Fabio Rojas, who's a sociologist at Indiana University, and that book is called Party in the Street, the Anti-War Movement and the Democratic Party After 9/11. And then I've also made a documentary film with Melody Shemtov and Marco Roldan that's called The Activists, War, Peace, and Politics in the Streets. So prior to the last year, I've worked mostly on social movements in the United States.
Wow, that's some depth. So what brought you to Glasgow?
Well, I came to Glasgow because I had a very exciting opportunity to be a research fellow here at the University of Glasgow. And this was a great opportunity for my family to come and get to know a new place in the world, not only to get to know Scotland, but to get to know Europe better. I have a 5-year-old daughter and a wife, and we are just loving Scotland and we are loving being in Europe.
Right. How long have you been here?
We've been here for a year and 1 month.
Right. And what's your impressions of life in Scotland is in relation to the States? Any plus points or any minus points?
Oh, yeah. Well, we love it here. Mm-hmm. I think probably the most interesting difference is that there's so much more of a walking culture here. So when we lived in Michigan, which is where we lived prior to being here, we owned 2 cars. And we basically needed 2 cars to get around and do our business. But here in Glasgow, we live right off of Byers Road, and we, you know, don't own a car, and we're able to get around and do everything that we need to do. We walk for most of what we need to do. But we also love how easy it is to take the subway from Hillhead to Buchanan Street. And sometimes we take a taxi. But we, you know, the transportation situation is just very different here. And we also love being able to just hop on the train and get down to Edinburgh. So it's been very different in terms of the way we get around and the way we're transported here.
You've come to Scotland at a very exciting time in Scotland's history. How did you observe it before you arrived? And was it a shock to your system when you did arrive?
Well, to be honest, I hadn't paid much attention to Scotland prior to coming. I mean, of course, I knew about Scotland and I'd read about Scotland and seen movies about Scotland, but I honestly didn't give a lot of thought to Scotland prior to coming here.
Would you say that's commonplace in America?
Yeah, I think that Americans are typically much more insular in the sense that, you know, they're really focused on America.
Yeah.
And I think that is true for me as well. Most of my research and professional life has really focused on the United States. And so, I mean, I was not unaware of the world and I've traveled, but I wouldn't say that I thought a lot about Scotland prior to a year ago.
Yeah, because you got quite a few items, for example, on YouTube, people being interviewed in the States, and the knowledge of the outside world, outside America, is sometimes quite, should we say, deplorable. And yet, I went, for example, in the summer to Italy, and the waiter came up and said, "Where are you from?" And we said, "Oh, from Scotland." He says, "Oh, William Wallace, Robert the Bruce." And, you know, we thought, wow.
Well, we knew about William Wallace and Robert the Bruce. I mean, I didn't know nothing about Scotland. So, but I think that's generally right. That my focus was on the United States. And, you know, I think that's also true for many people in the United States.
Right. How much did you know of British politics before you came? Or
modest. Yeah. I mean, I followed it modestly. Right. If I followed it in passing. Yeah. I wouldn't say I followed it closely.
What inspired you to do a survey on the Scottish independence movement?
Well, I am very interested in social movements, and I'm very interested in activism and political parties and party politics, and how social movements get mobilized and why people participate in them and what effect that has on the political system. So when I came to Glasgow and I saw the independence movement mobilizing, I went to an independence march in May in Glasgow and was absolutely fascinated by it. And just, I felt very drawn into it. I felt very much like I felt the first time I went to an anti-war protest in the United States after 9/11 in 2002. I went to my first protest and I felt very drawn in and very interested in what was happening. So I felt the same way when I went to that May 2019 rally in Glasgow.
And that inspired you to do the survey, or was that the start of the survey?
No, we didn't start doing the survey until August. What inspired me to do the survey was, first of all, this is just something that I've been doing in the United States. So I've done surveys in the anti-war movement in the United States that my book was based on. And then I also have a study that is looking at protest in the United States after Donald Trump has been elected president. And that study has looked at protests for women's rights, for the environment, for gun safety, for all sorts of issues. And so studying protest and looking at protest is sort of professionally a big part of what I do. So it was a very natural thing for me to think, there's this very interesting social movement going on here in Scotland, and I should take a look at it. And the way that I've done that is to do some surveys, and I have a small research budget, and so I'm able to pay students to help do that. And so we've been doing it, and we collected 1,300 surveys, and we've inputted the data, and now we have some results.
Would you like to go into a little bit more detail, put some meat on the bone of what the results were and what you found and what the...
Okay, yes, I would. That would be great. So first of all, I've told you that I've done 1,300 surveys at independence rallies in Aberdeen, Perth, Edinburgh, and Glasgow. But I'm also using data from the British Election Study. So wave 16 of the British Election Study, which was conducted between May and June 2019, had about 2,000 respondents from Scotland. So basically what I did was I looked at the questions for the British Election Study, and I selected a set of questions from that study and then created a survey that was just for independence demonstrators. So what that did was it enabled me to do a comparison of people who were being randomly sampled from all of Scotland as part of this British Election Study, and then compare that with the people that we'd be able to survey at the rallies.
Yeah.
So what this allows me to do is it allows me to do three kinds of analysis. First of all, I can look just at the people who are answering the British Election Study, just people in the general population. Then I can also look at people who are just answering my survey, who are just independence demonstrators, and then what I can do is I can compare those two things to one another.
Right.
So what I did was I looked at different levels of support that people gave to the independence movement. So I looked at, first of all, were people yes supporters or not? And I used the British Election Study for that. Then I looked at, of the people who were yes supporters, I looked at, were they attending a demonstration or not, right? And so the way I did that was comparing the British Election Study to the survey results I took. right? Then if people attended a demonstration, I looked at, did they join an organization for independence or not? So I've got three levels of, so you've got three levels of support, right?
Right.
Are you a yes supporter or not? Are you at a demonstration or not? And then are you a member of an organization or not? So what I wanted to do was understand different variables that might explain that increasing level of mobilization. So what I did was I looked at two kinds of variables. First of all, I looked at what you would call identity variables, which are variables about how people think about who they are politically. And I looked at three of them. First of all, Scottishness. Second of all, Britishness. And third of all, Europeanness. And so people were shown a list, Scottish 1 through 7, British 1 through 7, European 1 through 7. And then they could, one was considered low and seven was considered high. And people could indicate where they fit on each of those scales. So someone who thought of themselves as very Scottish and not very British would put seven for Scottish, one for British, and maybe three or four for European or something like that. So I have these three identity variables. And then I also had control variables for socio-demographic factors. So I had people's sex, gender, their ethnicity, their age and years, the year at which they completed their education, and their income in thousands of pounds. So then what I did was I analyzed these variables and how they corresponded with the increasing levels of mobilization. And so what I'll do is first I'll talk about the identity variables, and then I'll talk about the control variables. So the identity variables were Scottish, British, and European. And what we see is very clear results that being more Scottish and more European corresponds with people being more likely to support the movement. And people being more British corresponds with people being less likely to support the movement.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about this is that I gave the example where people were, you know, high on Scottish, low on British, and that's sort of a very simple example. But perhaps the more interesting examples is where people hold both kinds of identities,
yeah.
Right? So they might think of themselves as a six on Scottish and a four on British, right? So what they've got is they've got these identities that they're holding together, and then politics is bringing those identities into conflict, right? So the independence movement, in a sense, brings the Scottish and the British identities into conflict, right? And Brexit brings the British and the European identities into conflict. And so when people are faced with these conflicts, they have to make choices. And they have to think about, okay, well, I think of myself as both Scottish and British. Or I think of myself as British and European. But now politics is happening and I have to choose. And which am I more of? So one of the interesting kind of findings of this study looks at the way that these identities interact with one another, right? So probably the clearest result that I have in the whole study is that the British and the Scottish identities negatively interact with one another. So that as a person becomes more Scottish in their identity, the effect of their British identity is lessened. And likewise, as people become more British in their identity, the effect of their Scottishness is lessened. So there's this kind of dynamic interaction between the identities in terms of the way that people think about themselves. Also, the British and the European identities interact with one another, although the results are not quite as clear there. And so we may or may not talk more about that, depending on how interested you are in that. Then there's also the control variables or the demographic variables. The first interesting variable is age. And one of the things that we clearly see is that age comes up as important in all three of these models. So age, it corresponds negatively with mobilizing, with being a supporter of the movement. And what that means is that the supporters of the movement are a little bit younger than the non-supporters. So the yes supporters are about 5 years younger on average than the no supporters. But then when you look at once they get inside the independence movement, age actually has a positive effect. So the people who participate in a demonstration and the people who are more are members of organizations are a little bit older than the people who are not doing those things. The other variables, gender, education, ethnicity, and income, vary a little bit from equation to equation in terms of how important they are. Gender is never significant. So I know that my collaborator, Madeline Cancrow, talks about how in the 2014 referendum, there was a lot of discussion about how some people saw the Scottish independence movement as more male than more than female. And the results here show that if that was ever true, it's not true now. That there's fairly, there's equality in terms of both supporters and non-supporters in terms of gender. And then education, ethnicity, and income only matter in the equation that predicts who turns out at a demonstration. So one interesting result is that being a person of color makes a person a little bit more likely to turn out at a demonstration who's a, among, in terms of, in comparison to yes supporters and the general population. And then the yes supporters who turn out at rallies are also have slightly lower levels of education and also slightly lower incomes than people who turn out.
Right. That is quite quite in depth. And the latter point I would say was quite surprising to me is regarding education and income, because having gone on just about 90% of marches over, and rallies over the last 2 years, I've shared that experience I know with physicists, professors, doctors, pharmacists, so I wouldn't say they were of a lower education level or lower income.
We're just talking about averages.
Averages.
And we're also comparing to other yes supporters in the population. So the question is, if you look at yes supporters in the population versus yes supporters who turn out at demonstrations, the people who turn out at demonstrations have got slightly lower levels of education and income. So that's just, it is what it is.
I certainly find the fact that you talk about the equality of genders is refreshing, because certainly in 2014, the results of the actual referendum showed that a lot more, shall we say, middle-aged females voted against independence. And we tend to find now that there is a phenomenal great more balance of females coming becoming involved and very active.
Yeah, I don't see any gender balance or any gender bias at all.
No.
Right. So, I mean, which is, of course, for example, very different from the United States, where the Democrats tend to gain a lot of support from women, and the Republicans tend to get more support from men. So, but on this particular issue, I'm not seeing any kind of significant gender effects.
Mm-hmm. What lessons do you feel the independence movement could benefit from your research?
Well, probably the most interesting benefits, I think, would have to do with messaging. And the messaging effects, I think, are most interesting with regard to the interaction between Europeanness and Scottishness. So what I'm finding is that in the among the people who attend demonstrations, we're seeing a positive and significant interaction between European identities and Scottish identities. And basically what that means is that the message that, you know, the reason why we want independence is because we want to be part of Europe, that message is working with the people who support independence. That said, if you look at the general public and you look at that same issue, we don't see a positive and significant interaction between those two. So I think what that means is that the independence movement could benefit from having more public messaging trying to link those two things positively, because it's working with the people that support them, mm-hmm. but we're not seeing a significant interaction. What we're seeing in the general public basically is just a flat line,
yeah,
right, where there's no significant trend, either positive or negative. So that strikes me as, if I were going to look at these results and then guide, like, let's say a media campaign, I would say the media campaign should be to try to link those two in the minds of the general public.
How would you do that? Any thoughts from your past experience of how that
I'm not a marketing guru.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think I would talk about, you know, maybe one thing you could, what they could do would be to look at, maybe follow the lives of people who are from Scotland, living throughout Europe, and the interesting things they're doing in Frankfurt or in, you know, in Bonn or in Milan, you know, so sort of show the benefits of the European connection to ordinary people from Scotland, mm-hmm. you know. So I'm from Glasgow or I'm from, you know, Aberdeen, and now I live in Sicily, and this is what my life is like, and I'm so glad to be able to go home to Scotland. So, I mean, sort of personalizing that connection between Scotland and the rest of Europe would probably help a lot. And I suppose you could also look at, you know, the way that Scotland benefits from European policies. Like, what are the ways in which Europe is helping Scotland? Because I know that, at least through the mass media, one of the things I've heard a lot about is how, at least in theory, European laws hurt Scottish fishing, right? So that message has really penetrated.
Yeah.
So it might, I'm not saying that's true or false. I have no position on that. Mm. But I'm saying that that message has penetrated in the media. So, it would be interesting to see, you know, ways to counter that. Like, are there kinds of policies in European policies that really help Scotland? And that might be a way of sort of strengthening that Scottish-European interaction. Yeah.
I think the difficulty we have, certainly if, on that example of fisheries and the common fisheries agreements, is that trying to get across the message that it hasn't actually been Scotland negotiating those agreements with Europe, actually Westminster-based parties. And yet, despite the fact that we can continue to tell them, listen, this is Westminster MPs and appointees, because in fact there was one occasion when a fisheries minister couldn't attend, so they sent someone else from the office down there, shall we say.
Right.
Why not call on a Scottish right. minister to go and help insofar as the negotiations?
Well, there's truth and then there's public perception.
Yeah.
Right? So the issue is not really what's true. The issue is really what the public perceives.
Yeah.
Right? And so all I can tell you is I've heard a lot mm-hmm. about fisheries, and it hasn't, you know, I've heard a lot that says European policies hurt Scottish fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's what I've heard, right? So that's what people go on, is what they hear, not what's true,
yep.
right? So really it's a challenge. I mean, you're sort of telling a complex story, and it's difficult to tell complex stories to broad publics,
yep.
right? And so, you know, either you have to find a simple way to tell that complex story, or you have to find other issues where you can tell a simple story.
From past experience of people movements, how do you find the independence movement in Scotland?
Well, it's a very interesting movement. And one of the things that makes it interesting is that it is a, you know, it's a very strong and very well supported movement by a lot of people in the establishment in Scotland, right? So obviously, for example, the Scottish National Party is the ruling party in Scotland, and they're aligned with the Scottish independence movement, right? So there's this strong alignment between government and the movement here. And then
difficult one, because the grassroots movement is actually totally separate, and the government doesn't do any financial support. It supports in person, but it does not support financially.
It's aligned.
It's aligned, but right. not connected.
Right, I understand that. And yeah. I've definitely seen that in my surveys, that yeah. there's not much of a formal connection between the two, but there's definitely an alignment.
There's alignment, but also you will find that there are people of a Labour persuasion
yes,
liberal Democrat persuasion,
sure,
and even conservative persuasion,
yes,
who are aligned to the Yes movement.
Yes, that's definitely true.
And people of absolutely no political connection at all.
And that, but one of the things that I would say is that there's also a very clear support for Nicola Sturgeon in the independence movement. So she is a very beloved figure by the people who attend these rallies. So there is that kind of alignment. Then the challenge is that the opponent, so I guess most of the movements that I study in the United States, people show up at the site of their opponent, right? So for example, if you don't like Donald Trump, you show up at the White House, which is his official residence, and you protest him there. Whereas the rallies in Scotland, you know, if you have a rally in Glasgow or a rally in Edinburgh, you know, you're not really protesting your opponents, right? So the challenge, I think, for the movement is how to bring pressure onto the decision makers that they're trying to influence, which are in Westminster.
Yeah.
So that's the interesting kind of challenge. So as a result, I mean, the future of the movement really...
We do it democratically by supporting the SNP or the Green Party in the Scottish elections.
Right.
Or the SNP in particular in the general elections.
Right.
Or supporting SNP in the European elections. So we do it democratically rather than... Or if there is a... obviously, there's been complaints about the media bias or bias by omission from the British Broadcasting Corporation, so that we do have demonstrations outside the BBC Scotland headquarters at Pacific Quay. But as far as the thought of going down to Westminster, we wouldn't waste our energy.
Well, okay. But I think that the interesting... All right, so imagine this scenario. Imagine that the outcome of the December... the SNP wins handily in Scotland. But the Conservative coalition of the Conservative and Brexit parties win a majority together in Westminster. That puts Boris Johnson firmly in the Prime Minister's slot, and he then says no referendum for Scotland. So I think it will be very interesting to see under those circumstances. You have a Scottish government at Holyrood that has a mandate to call for independence, and then you've got a prime minister in Westminster who has a mandate not to have an independence referendum. So then my question would be, or at least the thing I would be very interested in seeing under those circumstances is, then how does the independence movement bring pressure to bear on Westminster to get the independence referendum that it wants?
Claim of right.
Okay.
So
what happens when they make a claim of right and Westminster says no?
They've already accepted it. They've already voted without objection to the claim of right at Westminster. So the claim of right gives us the right to determine a future already. So if that's why Nicola Sturgeon keeps on saying it's untenable to say you won't provide a Section 30 to give, should we say, legal authority for a referendum in Scotland.
Right.
So the referendum bill that is going through Holyrood at the moment, a lot of people in the independence movement feel it should have been done earlier, but it's being done now, so let's run with what's being done now. And the consideration is that it's going to be challenged. But it's going to be produced under Scots law. And Scots law is one of the three aspects that were always to be retained by Scotland. So if the UK government, which brought it into being the Supreme Court a few years ago, tries to take action against Scots law, I think it's going to be in for a big surprise. Because if it does try and go against it, then that is an absolute constitutional crisis against the claim of right.
Okay.
So, and refusing democracy.
Okay. So let's say, and I mean, none of us really know what's going to happen until
nope.
It happens, right?
Yeah.
So let's say that, let's say we have a scenario that I just put forward. The SNP has a mandate in Scotland. The Conservative and Brexit coalition has a mandate in Westminster. The Scottish Parliament passes the independence law. The referendum authorizes the referendum. Mm-hmm. Westminster says, no, we won't give a Section 30. So then the Scottish government brings a case to the Supreme Court. Okay. So two possibilities. One is that the Supreme Court says, Scotland, you're right, and you have the referendum. Okay. The other possibility is the Supreme Court says, no, you're not right. Okay, what then?
If the Supreme Court goes against the Scots law, the Supreme Court of Scotland, it cannot interfere with it because it's a separate law. And that's why I said it'll be a constitutional crisis.
Okay.
What basically would be occurring is that there will be a referendum. There's no section, we do not have to, but this is the reason why a Section 30 is going to be demanded and not requested.
Okay.
Nicola Sturgeon's words.
Well, when there's a referendum, I will be there with clipboards.
Absolutely.
I sometimes joke that that when the apocalypse happens, I'll be there with clipboards.
Yep. Yeah. So, because at the end of the day, things have not been, for some people, it's been too slow. For some people, it's just right. I will personally say I'm in the just right position because we have to bring, in a democratic society, we have to bring the people with us. And that means bringing the majority of people with us. And if something is done incorrect, legally and democratically, and eventually the people in Scotland who have been, shall we say, disinterested in politics will suddenly realise, wait a minute, we're getting shafted. We are actually getting ignored. I kept on hearing, oh, Scotland's getting ignored, but I didn't pay attention. When those people wake up, that is when the people of Scotland will decide for independence. Now, the SNP, all they are, is the vehicle to get us there, because they will be the one that obviously mandates it within a manifesto or a pledge.
Well, it's fascinating, and I can't wait to see it happen.
Yeah, because it's great to see it. That's why I feel you're here in an exciting time, because you're not seeing animosity, you're not seeing anger, you're not seeing riots, you're not seeing broken windows, you're not seeing burning vehicles. You're seeing a people quietly getting on with the job, seeing their own government that they elected for getting on with the job and doing a really good job, but you're finding parties which are based in England trying to persuade all the time not. So what do you feel the effects of your survey will have for Scotland going forward?
I think that the surveys help us to understand who's in the independence movement, who's in the independence movement, who's not in the independence movement, what promotes people getting more involved and more excited about independence. And so I think that both supporters and opponents of independence can look at these results and use them to guide their messaging, to think about who they've been mobilizing and who they haven't been mobilizing and how that can be done more effectively. So I would say what's exciting about my research is it's kind of a window into a group of people that, you know, you don't really get a window into, you know. So like, so for example, let's say there's a large protest in, or a large independence rally in Edinburgh. And there were clearly more than 100,000 people at this rally. And, you know, you show up at the rally and you see, I mean, you know, just a sea of blue and white, right? The impression that you get from that is here's just a group of people. There's just a big homogenous group of people. The exciting thing, I think, about my surveys is they help us see the differences among the people, right? So, I mean, you have people at these rallies that, for example, think of themselves as Scottish, but not British or European, right? You've got people who think of themselves as very European, somewhat Scottish and not at all British. You have people who think of themselves as British and Scottish, right? You have people that identify with none of these, right? So what you've really got is you've got heterogeneity in the people who participate. People are there for different reasons. They're being motivated by different things. And the study that I've done helps both supporters and opponents of the movement sort of see into that and better understand what's going on. So I think that a lot of people will find this research valuable to them.
And what would you like to see in the... If, obviously, you're neutral, but should, from what you've seen of Scotland, learnt about its politics, how would you see a political future within Scotland in itself, its relationship with Europe, and in particular the relationship in the world and the United States in a very particular way?
Well, I think I'm going to have to say I have no idea. I mean, I think that it's extremely complex. I mean, I guess the one thing I would say is that, you know, it seems particularly critical to resolve the question of Brexit before knowing what the best course is for independence. And certainly, if the Brexit debate has shown anything, it's definitely shown the complexity of separating political unions. So it's hard to know. I guess all I'm saying is it's definitely very hard to see the future. If anything, it's hard for me to see much past December 12th.
Yeah. On the flip side, within the independence, we would probably argue against that and say, well, no country has ever left the EU before, so there's never been a Brexit.
Right.
But multiple countries have left England.
Well, it is more complex because of the geographic proximity of Scotland to the rest of the United Kingdom. So, I mean, this definitely is a special case. I mean, I think there's definitely a difference between Canada and the United States and Australia becoming independent of the United Kingdom and Scotland becoming separate, simply because of the very close geographic relationship. So that's a special case.
But,
and an especially complex case, I think.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the white paper that was produced for the 2014 referendum and read through it. Have you read through that?
Yes.
You have. So you will agree with me that it was full of the word consultation and agreement.
Well, I'm not trying to argue the case on this. I'm just saying that clearly, whatever happens, it'll be very hard to see it happen. It's very hard to see in the future. I think that these kinds of processes, you know, they evolve step by step.
Yeah.
So you sort of asked me for a kind of a sweeping analysis of what was likely to happen in the future. And I'll just say, I would like to see what's going to happen on December 12th. So that will definitely tell us something about what's likely to happen next.
You can look forward to that.
But I'm interested in what's going to happen no matter what.
Yeah. Keep that clipboard ready.
I will.
Michael, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ray. Thanks for having me.
That's a pleasure.
On Indie Live Radio. Indie Prime.